Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the gruesome beheading of an American journalist, James Foley, at the hands of ISIS in Syria, almost 2 years after he was abducted on November the 22nd, 2012, after leaving an internet cafe in Benesh, Syria, a battle zone contested by Sunni rebels and the Assad regime. Michael Kelly, the front page editor for Business Insider, where he reports on military and defense, joins us to discuss his latest article at the Business Insider, One Big Question Surrounds the Murder of U.S. Journalist James Foley by ISIS, and the possibility that the Assad regime handed Foley over to ISIS. Then we will speak with Rhys Ehrlich, a veteran foreign correspondent just back from the Kurdish region of Iraq, who reports for the same news organization Global Post that James Foley was working for when he disappeared. We will discuss Rhys Ehrlich's efforts with Syrian officials to find out where and who was holding James Foley, and his latest book, Inside Syria, the backstory of their civil war and what the world can expect, as well as his impressions from just being on the ground in northern Iraq of how the offensive against the Islamic State is going. Then finally, we'll examine the latest efforts to bring calm to Ferguson, Missouri after 12 days of unrest, and speak with Clarissa Haywood, a political theorist at Washington University in St. Louis and the author of Justice and the American Metropolis and How Americans Make Race, Stories, Institutions, Spaces. We'll discuss whether, as Captain Ronald Johnson of the State Highway Patrol claims, a turning point has been reached, and what influence Attorney General Holder could bring to bear on the hunkered-down local police, and whether the prosecutor, Bob McCulloch, is impartial enough to make a case against the police officer who shot Michael Brown 6 times, a sentiment shared by protesters outside the St. Louis County Justice Center, where the grand jury was convened Wednesday. And joining us now is Michael Kelly, the front page editor for Business Insider, where he reports on military and defense. His latest article at the Business Insider is One Big Question Surrounds the Murder of U.S. Journalist James Foley by ISIS. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Kelly.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And James Foley was last seen leaving a internet cafe in Benish, Syria, which is a battle zone contested by Sunni rebels and the Assad regime, in November 22nd, 2012. And almost 2 years later, we see him, the world sees him being executed in a barbaric way on television, which has provoked the President of the United States to talk about ISIS or the Islamic State in terms of a cancer that has to be removed from humanity. What do you think is, at this point, there are indications, and there was an assumption, I think, from the beginning, was there not, that Foley was taken by Assad's people or, as the FBI believes, by an organized gang that then turned him over to Assad's people?
Well, yeah, it seems that there was more than an assumption, given that it was the FBI talking about this. And days after Foley was abducted, Global Post hired a independent firm to look for his whereabouts, and Global Post president Philip Balbani said today that they spent millions over the last couple of years trying to track him down. And in May 2013, they said that they have multiple independent reports from credible sources that James was being held in a Syrian government prison, which is under control of Syrian Air Force intelligence, which is pretty much Assad's elite intelligence unit. And what's unclear is how, if that information is correct, how he got from a Syrian Air Force intelligence prison to ISIS.
And apparently this Syrian Air Force intelligence service-run prison was also believed to be holding other Western journalists. Could it be that among them is the journalist who apparently is next up to be executed by ISIS?
Yeah, that's unknown. There are several Western journalists, including Austin Tice, that were believed to be abducted by the Syrian government or groups loyal to the Syrian government. And it's unclear if the Time correspondent was in this group, but we don't really know at this point at when they were abducted, where they were taken, and how they would be given to ISIS at some point over the last 2 years.
So in your article, Michael Kelly, at Business Insider, one big question surrounds the murder of U.S. journalist James Foley by ISIS. You suggest that Assad, or you quote a Syrian source who suggests that Assad feels cornered and is looking for leverage. Just explain further, if you will.
Sure. BBC journalist Kim Gatas, after this came out yesterday, she explained that it would make sense that Assad was holding these people, because that is what has been assumed both by the FBI and the money spent by the Global Post to find them. And Gatta said that this made sense of what she talked to as far as Assad could use this as leverage. And it brings up an interesting point, because if he could possibly use Western hostages as leverage by giving them to ISIS, then it would suggest that something that has been thought of before, which is that he has close ties to members of ISIS, because he's essentially facilitated their rise by releasing original members from prison in 2011, May 31st. And he knows full well what ISIS was doing over the last 2 years as they got more territory in Syria.
So, in other words, by extension, there is the possibility that Assad knew exactly what the fate would be of James Foley by handing him over to ISIS, and that this graphic and gruesome display that has outraged the world and outraged the President of the United States is, in fact, a calculated response, in effect, on Assad's part. So as long as his fingerprints on this, he's getting the results he wants. Is that...
What we know is that Assad knows full well what ISIS is capable of and what ISIS has been capable of from the beginning. And I quoted a Syrian diplomat who worked in the Syrian Foreign Ministry for decades, and he essentially explained that this is one thing that Assad is able to do, is that not only does he use terrorism to take the heat off himself, but he can also leverage these groups, because he was helping them when, during the war in Iraq, they would use Syria as a staging base, and he knew all about this. And Syrian diplomats have said that they had infiltrated ISIS very early on. So this all tracks with him knowing exactly what's going on, and really the mystery here is the fact that it seems that Syrian intelligence was holding James Foley, and this would be like the CIA losing a prisoner. It just doesn't happen. These are his elite troops. These prisons are not ones that have been overtaken by rebels at any point in the war. Really, his real strong Syrian intelligence bases. And so the question comes down to how James Foley, if he was captured by these pro-Assad groups and transferred to a Syrian rebel prison, which is what his family and Global Post and the FBI thought, how they got him from Syrian intelligence to ISIS.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Kelly, who's the front page editor for Business Insider, where he reports on military and defense issues. His latest article at the Business Insider is One Big Question Surrounds the Murder of U.S. Journalist James Foley by ISIS. But it's no secret, I've talked to people in the Syrian opposition, particularly on the secular side, and they say that there's been graphic evidence of Free Syrian Army soldiers being bombed on one side of the street while ISIS fighters are sitting at a coffee shop across the way. And it sort of makes sense, does it, that the ISIS is the gift that keeps on giving as far as Assad's concerned. He has tried to push the narrative to suggest that this revolution is not a democratically inspired revolution that was precipitated by the downfall of Gaddafi, and that regular citizens in Syria took to the streets and were massacred by his forces as they protested for freedom and democracy. And that it's always served his interest. And that's been his narrative all along, that this is either me or these crazy Islamists. So the extent to which he has nurtured this group, which you've just pointed out, goes back to Iraq. My understanding, and you've mentioned this in your article, is that now he's starting to go after them, and he's finally actually using his air force to bomb ISIS. Is that what you understand?
More or less, yes. From the beginning, he knows that he can use terrorism essentially as leverage, and he's essentially used both his forces and the growing strength of ISIS to squeeze the mainstream rebel opposition. So what's happening in Syria's biggest city right now is a good example of this. The rebels have held Aleppo for half of Aleppo for about 2 years now, but right now they're on the verge of losing their stake in Aleppo because the Assad regime is coming in from the south and the west and now the north. And ISIS, for the last year, has been pressing them from the east. So, essentially, Assad doesn't bomb ISIS positions, like the headquarters in Aleppo. He only started bombing their de facto capital of Raqqa in eastern Syria. But even then, he's bombing the actual city. So, the cynical view of this is that now he's trying to leverage the fact that he's a counterterrorism partner bombing ISIS so that the West can see him as the only option as far as fighting these terrorists, when, in fact, this plays right into his plan and his Iranian backers' plan that it's a true self-fulfilling prophecy. He allowed them to grow. And now he's saying, well, they're the problem and not me.
And when you mentioned his Iranian backers, it's obvious that also they are joining in the chorus, in effect, of trying to suggest that they could form some kind of alliance with the United States, at least a de facto one is already underway, is it not, in Iraq. I mean, there's no question that Maliki was, if not controlled by Iran, certainly influenced by Iran, and his successor from the same Dawa party, which was Iranian-based, is his, I believe the Iranians actually were behind urging Maliki out the door. So to that extent, the U.S. and Iran are working together, are they not? So it would be my assumption that the Iranians, through intermediaries, are saying, look, we're on your side, really, whether you like it or not, against these crazy guys who are executing everybody.
They definitely want that to be the case. And them backing Assad and Assad doing these things plays into that. As the Syrian diplomat said, now that ISIS is fully matured, the Assad regime and Iran offer themselves as partners to the United States. For the first time, Assad is striking ISIS in Raqqa, and what he calls a perverse harvest of the terrorist seeds Assad planted to quash the civilian-led reform movement. So if you look at Iran in the context of Syria, the U.S. Treasury Department last year sanctioned members of al-Qaeda because in that sanction they said that Iran was allowing al-Qaeda members to move from Afghanistan through Iran to Syria. And it's the same thing that they were doing to counter the U.S.-led invasion during the Iraq War, is that they would allow these Sunni extremists to travel through Iran and not stop them because they're serving their purposes, and that's essentially what the same thing that Assad did with ISIS, is that he released these guys from a notorious Syrian prison and then allowed them to grow into a problem. And then he can step back and say, look, I'm not the problem. They are now the problem.
But clearly, what would blow this out of the water is the very issue that we're discussing here right now, isn't it, Michael Kelly? That if you could put Assad's fingerprints on this, then Obama and everybody else would have to recognize how much we're being had. And what I find paradoxical about this situation is that many people that really seem to understand ISIS and what's going on, including the former head of British MI6 and the former head of counterterrorism at MI6, they have weighed in saying that bombing ISIS is the best thing that could happen to them, and that will be and is likely to be the response from President Obama, who expressed such outrage today.
Well, there's a certain needle to be thread here, as far as that goes, because if they want to draw the U.S. into a boots-on-the-ground intervention, then that would very much serve purposes of ISIS, who fought Americans in Iraq, and for Assad, because they're essentially taking care of a problem that he created and spending their American blood and treasure again to do that. But at the same time, ISIS has clear vulnerabilities from the sky. Even if Assad, up to this point, hasn't been willing to bomb them, and he still hasn't been willing to bomb them in open space, America has F-16s, as we've seen over the last couple weeks, that can simply pick out ISIS heat signatures and these convoys that are essentially riding free throughout the desert and take them out. And so the thought that bombing them will only bring trouble for America, I think it's more nuanced than that. I think that a full-scale invasion of sorts would be a problem, but for right now, in the short term, it really does rattle these extremists, the fact that they can't shoot down American F-16s, and American F-16s can see them from the sky and take them out. And that's why you've seen, when there are bombings in Iraq, there was a story in the Wall Street Journal today about how ISIS commanders are moving back to Syria because they have a safe haven there. So in theory, if the U.S., going on Barack Obama and John Kerry's strong words today, the U.S. were willing to hit ISIS wherever they are, they can really, really put some fear in them when, you know, they're going from their de facto capital of Raqqa in eastern Syria, and they're trying to go to Mosul, the second biggest city in Iraq, and they can no longer have safe passage.
So is that to say then that this disconnect or this paradox that ISIS is the enemy of the United States in Iraq and the enemy of the United States in Syria, is that over?
That is the paradox, in the sense that that's exactly what Assad wants. Assad is essentially making the argument that the enemy of the United States enemy is Assad's enemy as well. And so that means that it would put Assad and the U.S. on the same side. And that's exactly what he wants. But the U.S. has to be very careful there, because they're dealing with someone who has tortured tens of thousands, if not more than 100,000 people, both the ones that have been cataloged by Syrian police photographers who have come out, as well as the ones that are still in prison. This is a regime that we haven't seen this kind of scale of human cataloging in a long time, perhaps since World War II. So they have to be very careful of not being on Assad's side, but at the same time, ISIS is a clear threat to everyone in the world. So they have to thread the needle here, because ISIS is a clear threat that was facilitated and indirectly bolstered by Assad and his Iranian backers.
So given that Assad has been successful in changing the subject, that this is not a democratic revolution against a family dictatorship that has the divine right to rule through a dynasty and a kind of mafia rule at that, and using untold brutality, that basically what happened then to the democratic opposition? I mean, the CIA has supposedly given them arms. We know what happened to the arms that the U.S. gave to Maliki and the Iraqis that ended up in ISIS's hands. What happened to whatever efforts were made to bolster the democratic opposition in Syria?
Right. The U.S. has said that they're backing the opposition, but it's also come out in the last year that they were only training enough FSA soldiers and only giving enough weapons that they wouldn't lose. So that's not truly backing. The main criticism of Barack Obama's policy of essentially giving up Syria for either whether it's to get the U.S. out of the Middle East or whether it's to capitulate to Iran for a nuclear deal, the main criticism is that when the revolution started, you had tens of thousands of defectors from the Syrian army who were unwilling to shoot innocent protesters and kill their countrymen. And these defectors, many of them, went to Turkey. And so the argument is that you have these soldiers that are already trained. If the U.S. had trained them and given them arms and set up a military structure, which all these things have been done, but they were done in kind of a nonchalant way, not enough of a way to make an effect. And these soldiers, these Syrian soldiers, became upset. They said, well, it's not worth it. But the argument is that if you would actually have trained these people and put them under a structure, the proper Syrian military, the Supreme Military Council of Syria, then it really could have helped take the fight to Assad as well as bolster against ISIS. Now, no one knows how that would have worked out, but the alternative is that little U.S. backing to these rebels, so you allow Assad to create a situation where he allows these extremists out of prison, they organize, and they create these extremist groups. They start picking off the moderate opposition. They start recruiting members of the moderate opposition because of straight power. Assad leaves them alone and lets them grow. And the U.S. sits back and watches as this prophecy unfolds and evolves and becomes a serious problem where now if you try to pick out, there are still FSA, there's still a moderate opposition, but they're being squeezed by both Assad and ISIS in northern Syria. They're surrounded. The same thing happened in Deir ez-Zor in eastern Syria, where the Free Syrian rebels, they asked the U.S. for help through their channels, said, please help us because we don't have enough ammunition to fight ISIS and the regime at the same time. And they didn't get the help that they needed, and they were routed.
And just, just in closing, though, Michael, we've run out of time here. I just want to mention that the Pentagon has just announced that a U.S. secret military mission tried to free James Foley and other captives this summer, but failed. I take it there'll be more on that later.
Yeah, and some people are really amazed that this was even leaked because there aren't many details at all. It's hard to draw a conclusion on what the intelligence was, when this happened. It really just muddies the situation. So if this is all the information that's known about this mission, then it's troublesome because you don't know. This may put other lives at risk because why would they give up more hostages if they know that other hostages that were released gave information to the U.S. so that they could do this? I mean, the American Special Forces killed multiple militants on the ground when they went down there, even though there were no hostages involved. And this is a very serious mission, and we just don't know a lot about it.
Well, Michael Kelly, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Kelly, who's a front-page editor for Business Insider, where he reports on military and defense issues. His latest article at the Business Insider is One Big Question Surrounds the Murder of U.S. Journalist James Foley by ISIS. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking with a veteran correspondent just back from the Kurdish regions of Iraq who reports for the same news organization that James Foley was working for.
عيوني جيت اني بجوز عيونه على صمار الحنطاوي
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Rhys Ehrlich, who's a veteran foreign correspondent just back from the Kurdish region of Iraq, who reports regularly for Global Post, CBC, ABC Australia, Radio Deutsche Welle, and NPR. His books include Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, and The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy in the Middle East Crisis, and Conversations with Terrorists, Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. And his latest book is Inside Syria, The Backstory of Their Civil War and What the World Can Expect. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rhys Ehrlich.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And since you report for Global Post and the American reporter whose execution just appeared on tape at the hands of ISIS, a British-speaking or an British-accented, I should say, English-speaking terrorist delivers a manifesto against the United States, and then they chop this poor guy's head off in front of the world. It's outraged the President of the United States. It's outraged everybody. Of course, that's probably what they had in mind. But, you know, you've been to, obviously been in Syria a lot, reporting for the same news organization as James Foley. What's your understanding of his history? Because it goes back 2 years. His capture goes back 2 years. And what interaction have you had in terms of either him or his capture?
Well, James Foley was a freelancer on assignment for Global Post and others. He snuck into Syria, as did many reporters in that time. What you did is you crossed the border from Turkey with people that you trust. At some point, he was kidnapped by Islamist groups or group and ended up in the hands of the ISIS. Exactly what happened to him is not clear because the editors lost and his family lost track of him after he was captured. Last year, I went to Syria on assignment for Global Post and others, and I inquired about Foley's status and did the Syrian government know anything about him, and they said they did not, that he was likely under in the areas not controlled by the government. It was a horrible tragedy. It's something that all journalists and freelancers and indeed Americans in general were abhorred by what happened. And it's a very dangerous job. You know, I take risks, other journalists take risks, but nobody expects something like this to happen.
But there are also reports that you were there asking the Assad government or representatives of it about Foley and his whereabouts. And did they stonewall you?
Well, they said, and I'm going to paraphrase here, that he came into Syria illegally because he crossed the border from Turkey without having a visa, and the Syrian government couldn't be responsible for anything that might have happened to him. So, and they completely denied that they had any knowledge of his whereabouts.
But the assumption was that they did, right?
Well, there were some rumors to that effect. I was not able to confirm whether that was true or not.
Again, I'm speaking with Rhys Ehrlich, who's a veteran foreign correspondent just back from the Kurdish region of Iraq, who reports regularly for Global Post, CBC, ABC Australia, Radio Deutsche Welle, and NPR. His books include Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy in the Middle East, Conversations with Terrorists, Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire, and his latest book is Inside Syria, The Backstory of Their Civil War and What the World Can Expect. And I guess just to the point of your subtitle of your book, Rhys, what can the world expect? Just more misery? I mean, it's a hideous situation. It's amazing to think it wasn't so long ago that Hillary Clinton promised that Assad was going to go, and now he's back stronger than ever. And as we've mentioned, ISIS has been the gift to him that keeps on giving. And now the U.S., of course, is going after ISIS in Iraq, but leaving them alone in Syria because it sort of catches us in this contradiction, right? We're against ISIS in Iraq, but not necessarily in Syria.
Well, in the short run, it's clearly a very, very difficult situation with a series of very bad actors competing for control. Looking more in the medium and longer run, I think what we're seeing is a sign of a weakened U.S. empire, where before the U.S. would send in troops, occupy a country, and at least for a time appear to make things stabilized. That happened in Afghanistan and Iraq. Of course, the reality was quite different. The U.S. actually lost the wars in both Iraq and Afghanistan. So I think the fact that the U.S. can't do anything in Syria is a sign of its overall weakness, not anything particular to Obama's policies. I think with time, the people of the Middle East will settle this for themselves. The Arab Spring in Tunisia, for example, has on the whole done well, although they have plenty of problems. They do have a stable situation in which left and progressive forces are able to organize. So there is hope.
But the U.S. in what they're doing in Iraq, and you're just back from Iraq, so I want to get your impressions of what's going on there in the Kurdish region. My understanding is that at this point, our policy is to bomb.
In Iraq, that's absolutely correct. And the U.S. Policy is to engage in targeted airstrikes coordinated with the Peshmerga. By the way, the U.S. does have troops on the ground. That's who they're doing the spotting and the directing of these airstrikes. And then the combination of the airstrikes and the Peshmerga are supposed to defeat the IS. The problem is when you get outside of the immediate Kurdish region into places like Mosul and other parts of Sunni Arab Iraq, how is the U.S. going to find partners, military capable partners and government officials who can run the area afterwards? That's the long-term problem, the medium-term problem. The U.S. is very good at blowing things up. They're not very good at making them work afterwards.
Well, but we also have a total lack of diplomacy. I mean, first of all, we have this ridiculous, you know, petulant foreign policy that says we won't talk to you until you behave exactly the way we want to, and then we'll talk to you, which means that we can't talk to Assad, we can't talk to Hezbollah, we can't talk to the Iranians, we can talk to the Russians, and then, of course, they become our intermediaries, and they have their own agenda. And, of course, we've been talking to Maliki forever, asking him to go, and he hasn't been listening. And we still believe somehow that Iraq is still a country. I mean, that's my greatest concern, is that we don't have any diplomacy, and we have a lot of military muscle, but I don't get an impression that we have people on the ground who know what's going on, who speak the languages and understand the people and can talk to them.
Well, I think the U.S. diplomats and even some of the intelligence people that I've met over there are very smart people. They do have, or at least the ones I've met, have a Kurdish or Arabic language skills. And they're not stupid. The problem is with the policy.
Well, by the way, just not to give the wrong impression here, I know the people on the ground. One of them that used to do that is Bob Baer, is a good friend of mine. I understand that they're very talented and they do speak the language, but my sense is that people in the National Security Council, on the top, the people in Washington, are just not, they're just talking to themselves.
I think that's true. I think they, the Obama administration tried a plan A, that failed, plan B, C, and we're down to somewhere around X or Y by now. Each of the plans, let's take Iraq, since I was just there. The Maliki government was brought in by the United States because the previous government had failed. And it was talked up, much as we're hearing about the new prime minister, was talked up as the guy who can really bring people together and so on. Almost immediately after the most recent election, or the election before the most recent one, he then proceeded to attack the Sunni politicians, have them arrested, try to arrest his vice president, and the political situation broke down. The U.S. talked to these guys, but didn't have the power to force an agreement, nor should they have, frankly. And it's just simply outside of the U.S. control militarily and diplomatically to, by itself, have much of an impact, perhaps with Europeans or better yet, even other Arab countries, regional countries. If the U.S. had may stop making these ridiculous demands on Iran about its non-existent nuclear weapons and talked with Iran about a modus vivendi in Iraq, it would have had a lot more positive results than anything the U.S. has done militarily or diplomatically so far.
So, Risa, since you're just back from the Kurdish region of Iraq, where all of the military activity has been, particularly over the retaking of the Mosul Dam, I must say there for a while, I was pretty concerned, and imagine a lot of people were, that this murderous nihilistic group, ISIS, could have been, certainly had the capability to blow up that dam, which in itself is an accident waiting to happen because it has to be maintained because it was so poorly built. That didn't happen. What's your understanding of how we dodged that bullet?
Well, it's not at all clear that ISIS wanted to blow up the dam because that could have flooded Sunni Arab areas that were there seeking to control or want to at least have popular support. So I'm not at all clear that they planned to blow it up. But militarily, ISIS was on the offensive. They got within 30 miles of Erbil, the capital of the Kurdish region where I was based. And it was clearly a very big threat to the Kurds and to Sunni Arabs in the areas that they had taken over. So the U.S. airstrikes appeared to have slowed that in the short run. The question, as I mentioned before, is what happens in the medium and the long run.
So what's your sense then? My sense is that you already have a divided country in any case, and the Kurds have been going their own way for some time now. The U.S. is hoping the new guy that replaced Maliki will somehow be the miracle worker that'll stitch this broken country together, which seems a complete pipe dream. And by the way, you know, he's from the Dawa party, which the Iranians, if they don't control it, they certainly influence it. What happens to the Sunni, though? Assuming, and this is a big assumption, that somehow that, as the president warned today, that these ISIS people are from a different century and he more or less placed them beyond the pale as though they should be exterminated. And I assume that that's what the U.S. will try to do, but they obviously won't be successful because it has a religious component, does it not, this whole movement? It's not just a military operation. So you can't bomb a faith away, even if it's a somewhat distorted and corrupted form of Islam.
Well, I guess two sets of questions there. In terms of the religious impact, of course, ISIS uses religion. I say they've reversed engineered it. Basically, they decide who they want to kill and then come up with religious justifications for doing it. And there are lots and lots of Sunni Muslims, not to mention other Muslims and other faiths, who don't think what ISIS is doing has anything to do with religion. It's a straight grab for power. And they're using ethnic cleansing in areas where they know they'll never control the local population, but at least they can drive them out. And of course, they use lots of religious rhetoric to do it. There's two, in terms of a longer-term solution, there's two ideas floated that I heard during my trip. One would be to turn Iraq into a confederation of three almost independent states, a Shia area in the south, a Sunni area in the middle, and a Kurdish area in the north. And they would have a common foreign policy and, you know, currency and a few things like that, but they would be largely independent. If that doesn't work, then Kurdistan is simply going to declare its independence, take as much of the area as they can hold on to because the borders are in dispute. The Shia will probably end up doing the same. And then, depending on who's in power in the Sunni area, you would have either a Sunni state run by non-ISIS forces or a lawless failed state, which would be dangerous for everybody. Now, neither of those options are very good, but those are the ones that shows you how far the conditions have devolved since the U.S. invasion of 2003, which set a lot of this stuff off.
But it's my understanding that the Sunni tribal leaders who have an alliance of convenience with ISIS, there's a danger that they could be collateral damage if we start bombing Sunni areas, that they are ready to make a deal. But a part of their deal is that to break up, not to be a part of Iraq. And that's why nobody in Washington wants to meet with them.
Well, I think there's different forces. We're not talking about a unified party or political movement. You have the former Baathists, the former supporters of Saddam Hussein. You have tribal chieftains. You have ethnic groups within the Sunni areas. So, and they don't speak with one voice. I think what right now they're all united in wanting to get rid of ISIS, and that's the key struggle.
Yeah, but nobody's talking to them and to coordinate them. I mean, they might want to.
That's not quite true. Uh-huh. The Kurds are certainly having their meetings.
Right.
In fact, the little known piece of information that I picked up while I was over there, one of the reasons the Kurds were caught so much by surprise when ISIS started its offensive a few weeks ago was the Kurds thought they had a deal with the tribal chiefs and the others allied with ISIS to not attack the Kurdish area, but they would direct their fire south. And that turned out not to be the case, and that's one of the reasons they were forced to retreat so rapidly. So there's lots of talks going on. The question is, who's going to stick up for their word and what positions are they going to take?
Yeah, and I can't imagine that the Sunni tribal leaders and even the ex-Baathists are in a very secure situation if they're double dealing with ISIS, who control the territory that they're in.
Right. Well, it's a throwback to the kind of warlord politics that existed in the region centuries ago. You don't know who you can trust and for how long. There were some tribal chiefs who rebelled against ISIS in the Deir ez-Zor area of Syria. I was just reading about them today. And they were fed up with ISIS rule, and ISIS cracked down quite severely on them. So there's liable to be a lot of fighting among the Sunnis in Iraq as well.
Well, Rhys Ehrlich, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Rhys Ehrlich, who's a veteran foreign correspondent just back from the Kurdish region of Iraq, who reports regularly for Global Post, CBC, ABC Australia, Radio Deutsche Welle, and NPR. His books include Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy in the Middle East Crisis, and Conversations with Terrorist Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. And his latest book is Inside Syria, The Backstory of Their Civil War and What the World Can Expect. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about whether after 12 days of unrest, calm is returning to Ferguson, Missouri.
Even the warmth of a mother's arms could not keep a son from harm. Standing where the gun was drawn, overcome, done and done, he gone.
Murder.
She'll shell like a bell and run. The blood burst, body temperature fell and plunged. And in the time it took the medics to come, the breath eased out of his lungs. And his soul.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Clarissa Haywood, who's a political theorist at Washington University in St. Louis, whose research and teaching focuses on questions central to understanding and evaluating political life. She is the author of Justice and the American Metropolis, and her latest book is How Americans Make Race, Stories, Institutions, Spaces. Welcome to Background Briefing, Clarissa Haywood.
Thank you. It's nice to talk with you.
And there appears to be a turning point in these 12 days of protests in Ferguson, in St. Louis, near where you are, Clarissa, with Captain Johnson, the head of the Missouri State Highway Patrol, saying that they've reached a turning point. And, of course, the Attorney General, Eric Holder, is meeting officials today in St. Louis. After 12 days, how are you feeling, and how are you not, your neighbors, your colleagues? After all, you know, this city, and particularly Ferguson, is the focus of national attention, if not global attention.
Right. I think that many people in St. Louis, and especially people who've been very involved in the events in Ferguson, are feeling exhausted. As you said, it's been going on for we'll be coming up on 2 weeks. I think there's been a lot of frustration. I think there has been a lot of divisiveness, in the sense that different communities and different people are looking at these events differently and have conflicting perspectives on them. But I think tired and, hoping to move forward and hoping to have some progress.
Well, the Pew Research study that came out on Tuesday indicated that the whole incident was being seen along racial lines. And is that the case in St. Louis, that the information is somewhat balkanized, or at least people choose their reality, African-Americans on one side and whites on another?
I think that that is broadly correct. It might be a little bit of an overstatement, but I think absolutely there's a different perspective that's coming from different parts of the St. Louis metropolitan area, and that certainly that perspective divides along racial lines.
So then how does reality intrude here? Is it all up to an inquiry, which obviously, as long as it's in the hands of the local police, is very suspect?
Absolutely, you're right. I think one way that reality intrudes is we actually do have some pretty undeniable facts and statistics about racial inequalities in Ferguson, which aren't, they're not subject to people's different interpretations or perspectives. So, for example, the composition of the local government, the composition of the police force. I mean, some of these, the disproportionate number of arrests of young African Americans compared with white people in Ferguson, we have some data that suggests that there is a reality, and the reality suggests that there is a racial inequality that's taking place long-term, long before the shooting of Mike Brown.
Again, I'm speaking with Clarissa Haywood, who's a political theorist at Washington University in St. Louis, whose research and teaching focuses on questions central to understanding and evaluating political life. She is the author of Justice and the American Metropolis, and her latest book is How Americans Make Race, Stories, Institutions, Spaces. But when the chief of police, presumably he does do press conferences, has he ever been asked by any local reporters, why is it that of a police force of 53 or 56, I'm not sure, but are there only three black officers and the rest are white?
I have seen a few press conferences that he's done, and I haven't seen him give a good answer to that question. So he has said things like, our recruitment efforts have not worked well, we're going to redouble our efforts, but he hasn't given a clear explanation of what causes that racial disparity.
And of the six council members that represent Ferguson, one of whom is African-American, and the same is true of the school board, has anybody asked them to justify this apparent disparity?
That I don't know, but there has been a lot of conversation about what are some of the reasons that we see the disparity. So I don't know if the city council people themselves have been asked that question, but I know there's been a lot of discussion among political scientists about why it is that we see that in Ferguson.
But it's so obvious that it's hard to justify, isn't it? I mean,
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's, clearly hard to justify. Yes, it's an enormous issue, and I think it's sort of a root cause. And again, I would say that when you ask does reality intrude, I would say this is one of the really important places where reality intrudes, which is we have a community that is about two-thirds African-American, and as you said, almost all of the elected officials are white. And I actually think the school board is also all white. So that's another piece of that.
Sure.
Of that inequality.
So, Clarissa, with last night, there was some violence, and there was an African-American man killed in a different part of the town.
Right.
But when Captain Johnson, and of course there's been some questions about who's in control there with overlapping jurisdictions and National Guard, State Highway Patrol, County Police, and local Ferguson Police. But since Captain Johnson seems to be the point man there, when he says that there's a turning point, do you feel that being there, that there is a turning point?
As you said, there was violence last night. There was what appeared to many people on the ground. It was not there, although it was, following what many people on the ground were saying, what appeared to many people to be an excessive use of police force in response to what I believe was the throwing of a water bottle, which doesn't seem, to threaten the lives of the police. I think we really have to see what happens tonight. So I think the proof is in, what actually happened. So there wasn't a turning point last night. We still had the police limiting media access to the protests. We had a show of force by the police that many people, myself included, think was excessive. So I think we have to see the evidence of the turning point, you know, going forward by looking at what happens tonight and in the nights to come.
But with the Attorney General there, the number one law enforcement officer in the country, who has already been defied at least on two occasions by the Ferguson police and presumably its chief of police, the Justice Department asked them not to release that video of the store, the apparent robbery over a few cigarillos or cigars. Then apparently Holder said to them directly, "Get those damn tanks off the streets." And they didn't. They didn't. So is there going to be a meeting? Is there anything on local television of Holder meeting with these people, with this chief of police? Because it feels as if these guys, the local cops and the county cops, are hunkering down. They're surly. They're angry. They think they're being overrun by FBI men and outside forces. That usual turf, those usual turf battles that go on in law enforcement apparently are pretty seething from what I'm told.
Right. I think your analysis is right, that there is a turf war. And I think my sense is that the county police and the local Ferguson police feel, my sense is that they feel that the criticisms are unwarranted and that there's a certain arrogance coming from these local police officers that they don't feel the need to take seriously and to respond to the criticisms that are being leveled at them.
But doesn't this Officer Wilson have surrogates who've been on the local St. Louis media trying to spin their side of the story that he's...
Yes, absolutely.
And how's that working? What's your sense of whether this is working in the sense that... I mean, it's pretty hard. First of all, it's hard to get your head around the idea that just because this Michael Brown may have grabbed a couple of cigars at a convenience store, that he should be shot. And it turns out the police officer who shot him didn't even know about that event. So they are trying to do what they can to criminalizing the victim or blaming the victim and make it seem like he deserved what he got. And I'm just wondering if that's having any success. And I just don't know how this man is going to defend himself, this policeman, and what his surrogates are saying that could justify the fact that he shot this young man six times.
Right. Well, you know, you raise a couple of really important points there. So one of the things I'm thinking about as I'm listening to you describe this scenario is that one of the great injustices is that the victim isn't there to speak for himself. So all of this victim blaming that's coming after the fact, he doesn't get a chance to defend himself. However, I think there are something like half a dozen witnesses who were present, including the young man, Michael's friend who was accompanying him, but also some witnesses who didn't know one another, who were in different vantage points, up in an apartment where they could see down. One woman isn't even from the community. She happened to be visiting, I think, her employer or employee in the apartments and witnessed the events. And it seems like there are half a dozen witnesses who support Michael's friend's version, description of what happened. In terms of what effect will Officer Wilson's surrogates have on people's opinion, I think that people tend to embrace claims and evidence that support the view that they already have, and people tend to ignore claims and evidence that disconfirm beliefs that they already have. So in terms of the average citizen, my guess is that the effect is going to be very different depending upon what that citizen's point of view was prior to listening to those claims.
Well, my sense is that that so far, the fact that the family have their own autopsy done,
and
once that was released, I think a lot of people recognized that this is next to impossible to justify what happened. And apparently now the Justice Department, who've ordered their own autopsy,
they've reached the same
conclusion as the independent autopsy did. So why isn't the governor or somebody there calling for an independent prosecutor? How can the local prosecutors, who obviously have a longstanding relationship with the police, how could they conduct a thorough examination? Because there are limits to what the FBI and the Justice Department can do. They can only operate under civil rights statutes, denying somebody their civil rights. When it comes to murder and manslaughter, et cetera, that's a local jurisdiction, and therefore you need to have I think, a real credible prosecutor. So what's your understanding of the prosecutor and his relationship to the local police?
So I agree with you wholeheartedly, and I agree with everything you said, and I would further that by saying even if it were the case that the local prosecutor was capable of being objective, the perception is that he's not. And I think that, you know, to have a legitimate process, we need an independent prosecutor. My understanding is that today's protests, which took place in Clayton, Missouri, which is the municipality that's the county seat for the county of St. Louis, that the protests there were specifically around this issue, and that crowds are mobilizing to make just the point that you made about the need for a neutral, objective, and independent prosecutor, given the ways that the local prosecutor is caught up in the case and in relationships with some of the parties.
Well, the St. Louis County prosecutor, Robert McCulloch, he's with the grand jury today, right? It's their hearings began on Wednesday, so he's certainly not stepping down. But given the demonstration...
No, but I'm saying that's what the protests are about. So they're outside, you know, they're in St. Louis County, and this is what the people, the citizens want. But I've seen no indication that that's going to happen.
Well, just in closing then, Clarissa Haywood, you would think then that somebody in the community, the city fathers, the establishment, for the want of a better description, might well be influenced by what I imagine the Attorney General Eric Holder is saying is, you know, the eyes of the nation, the eyes of the world are on you. This looks incredibly bad. If you don't get this right, it's going to be so much worse. I mean, I'm assuming that that's the argument being made.
Right. Well, I think at the local level, the Ferguson level, I just think that they are completely not equipped for this and are lacking the sort of the skill set to draw the conclusions that you've drawn just now.
I see.
So to listen to the Attorney General. So I think this is a small town. It's a small police force. This is a city council that's used to dealing with, you know, small town issues. And I think you're right, and it's a bad move to not listen to the Attorney General, but I wouldn't be surprised if they continue.
Well, Clarissa Haywood, I thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was great to talk with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Clarissa Haywood, who's a political theorist at Washington University in St. Louis, whose research and teaching focuses on questions central to understanding and evaluating political life. She's the author of Justice and the American Metropolis, and her latest book is How Americans Make Race, Stories, Institutions, Spaces. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Time one night in America.